Here we go. All right. So first off, this year is dedicated, along with the entire program, in memory of Ben Lax, dedicated by Michael and Marshall Lax. May Ben Lax's neshama be a benefit to all of our learning, both that we had previously throughout the day, as well as continuing to the end of this program. First and foremost, before I share sources in the chat, I wanted to just ask a question, and hopefully we can get some answers interactively, but if not, it is what it is. I just want people to think about this question. Is Judaism as a religion primarily particularistic or universalistic? And just so we all know how to define these terms, Google defines universalist as advocating loyalty to or concern for others without regard to national or other allegiances. And Google defines particularist as exclusive attachments to one's own group, party, or nation. So let's say this. If you believe that Judaism is primarily particularist, give a thumbs up, either physically or in the chat. And if you believe that Judaism is primarily universalist, give a wave, either in the chat or in person. Again, this doesn't measure crowd results as much as to hear where people are so that we can think about this idea. What I want to argue is that both of these play an important role, not only in how we see Judaism as a religion from a scholarly point of view, but also how we see our relationship to the religion that we all know and love, that religion that we call Judaism. And I want to do that in two ways, by exploring two separate case studies. The first case study I want to explore is the holiday of Sukkot. What does the holiday mean, and who is the holiday meant for in particular? And the second one I want to explore is Judaism's relationship to Zionism, looking at different approaches to that and how these two ideas play out. In the realm of Sukkot, looking at Judaism's approach to the other, to non-Jewish culture, and in the case of Zionism, looking at our inter-Jewish relationships and seeing if we can figure out where Judaism falls on the scale from universalism to particularism. And so with that in mind, I'm going to just quickly put my link in the chat. I hope that it's still copy-pasted. There we go. And I do want to just note that these sources are mainly notes, they're bullet points. I'm going to be doing relatively little reading inside. I want this to really be a discussion amongst us from what we believe to be this case. For those just joining now, I'm going to put the sources back in. I know there was at least one person who was unable to access them online, so I'm going to try not to be reading too much inside. If I am, I'll point out which source that is. So the first question I wanted to explore was the question of Sukkot. What does Sukkot as a holiday represent? And in fact, who is that holiday meant for? Is it meant only for Jews? Or is it meant for the entire world? And we might think that it's meant for the entire world based on some of our sources. We have in particular the prophet Zechariah, who says that eventually one day all of the nations will come and celebrate Sukkot. Rav Eliezer Melamed, author of the incredible Bnei Halacha series, writes that Sukkot will be the Evan HaBochen of a holiday. It will be a touchstone holiday for other nations, not only the Jews, to be able to all come together and bring sacrifices. However, as we continue down Jewish tradition, we'll see that it's a little bit less clear where we end up falling. Because if we go through the Talmud, for example, we have a fascinating understanding of what the sacrifices of Sukkot are meant to represent. This is source number 3. We will be reading from this one a little bit. And it starts with Rabbi Elazar saying that we have Shivim Parim, we have 70 cows that are sacrificed throughout the holiday of Sukkot. And we're asking, what do these represent? Shivim Parim Keneged Mi, Keneged what? Keneged Shivim Umos. They're regarding the 70 nations of the world. Par Yechidi Lama, Keneged Uma Yechida. That each individual cow that is sacrificed is on behalf of a different nation of the world. And the example that this text gives, again in source number 3, is that it gives a mashal of a human king saying that I'm going to have a big feast that's going to last for several days. But then at the very end is going to be a private, very small feast that he can get pleasure from that and that alone. And that's how we think about Sukkot in this particular telling. That primarily, Sukkot is, not primarily, but initially at least, Sukkot is meant for other nations. We give sacrifices on behalf of them, leading up to the grand finale, Hashem and Israel together individually as a private unit. And then finally, the sages of the lament, because now we don't have a Beis HaMikdash anymore. We don't have somewhere that we can bring these sacrifices. So who on earth is going to bring sacrifices on behalf of the other nations? We see that in this understanding, we're still within the context of Judaism being primary here. That the sacrifices on behalf of the Jews are what it leads to the nations having that positive relationship. So we're getting a little bit more particular than we had before. Zechariah made it seem that Sukkot is one day going to be for all of the nations. Single-handedly, we're all going to come together. And this Gemara, admittedly taking place before that end point, is still in a time of imperfection, says that everything is in the Jews' hands, but we're still operating on a universalist mission to save, to help, to assist other nations in their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with Hashem. Things, however, get a little bit more particularist as we continue going on our journey through the oral law. Source number 4, for example, which the translation got moved to the second page of my source sheet, is from a very, very long Agadata in the beginning of Maseches Avodah Zarah, in which we say that the nations came to God and they said, Hashem, we want to be able to do your work in the world too. We want to be able to be a chosen people also. Give us a commandment. Give us Shabbos. We'll keep Shabbos. It's something that the Jews seem to do well. We want to do it too. We think it'll be a nice way to connect. And Hashem says, what are you talking about? I'm not going to give you Shabbos. You think you can just request this from me and I'm just going to entrust you with this? I don't know what you're going to do. I don't know if I can, trust you with this kind of relationship with me. I'll give you an easy mitzvah. I'll give you sukkah. Sukkah is a mitzvah that doesn't require much financial loss from you. You build a hut outside, you sit in it, you eat in it. That's all you have to do. It's very, very easy. And so Hashem were to give them sukkah, but immediately, were that to be the case, each and every nation would come and would take their materials and they would build their sukkah. And then there would be a very, very hot week. You know, we just had a hot week here in Toronto, though there's a joke that I've been telling my American family that my first few weeks in Toronto and hasn't gotten over 35 degrees. Nonetheless, evidently that is rather hot here. So Hashem will give us that warm 35, maybe even 40 degree weather, maybe 50, whatever Celsius means. I'm still figuring out the system. But something very, very hot. And immediately nations will say, I'd rather go to my air conditioning. You know, what am I doing out here? I can't take this. What was I thinking? And they'll tear down their sukkah and they'll go inside and they'll enjoy a nice cold beer. And that'll be that. So this is still continuing on this journey, going a little bit more particular, a little bit more focused on the Jewish relationship here, saying that even if the nations were to ask to participate, it wouldn't end well. Finally, and in my mind, one that takes the cake on this is from a Medrash in Vayikra Rabbah that talks about Sukkot in particular, talking about the different mitzvot that are associated with it. And its parable is like how to figure out who owns these between Jews and non-Jews. And it uses a parable of two people who are fighting with each other. And when the dust settles, you don't necessarily know who won. But whoever comes up holding the sword is the one who's victorious. They clearly slew their enemy. So too, in the case of Sukkot, we have this battle between the Jews and the nations. And finally, the smoke clears. And who comes holding the lulav, championing it like a sword, but the Jewish people. And that's how we know that ultimately Sukkot is a holiday for the Jewish people. So we've traveled through sources from a rather particularist read into, sorry, from a rather universalist read into a rather particularist read of the holiday of Sukkot and these relationships. But the point is that all of these voices are within the tradition. Rav Malavid was the one who commented on the Zechariah line in Pinei Halacha, saying that this is still the future. The future is still going to be a universalist message of Sukkot. Both of these are playing a role in our tradition. And as of now, at least, it's a little bit hard to see which one ultimately ends up winning. We have both as live options within the tradition. So that's talking about the relationship between Jews and non-Jews from a universalist to particularist range. Now I want to hone in on a particular case study of inter-Jewish relations, a topic that many of us can relate to. I've even heard that many in Canada are more passionate about than many in the US for whatever reason happens, which is our relationship to Zionism, to the state of Israel, as opposed to just the land of Israel. And through this, I took particularly from two essays, one that is already published very easily available online by Rabbi Tuli Hartstark, the head of school at SAR, I believe the high school, might be the lower school as well, but I believe primarily the high school in Riverdale, New York. And a second essay that is yet to be published, hopefully will be published in about a month or two, by a friend of mine, Rabbi Avram Wein, published in this source sheet with his permission, who is now serving as assistant rabbi at Congregation Keter Torah in Teaneck, New Jersey. And Rabbi Hartstark has this very long essay. I gave the title, if you search it on Google with his name, as long as his name is spelled correctly, it's one of the few names I've seen that is harder to spell than Rabbi Torchiner's name. though I learned how to spell Rabbi Torchiner's name, I'm still messing up Hartstark. Regardless, so if you search that, you can easily find this. You can easily read what he says. I took this paragraph because I think it really sums up his argument very well. I'm not going to read it inside. I'm just going to sum up what he articulates as the paradigms of relating from the diaspora to the state of Israel. And he outlines four models. Number one is what he calls the negation of the exile, which is basically to say that all Jews belong in the land of Israel, full stop. The exile is over. Reshit tzmichat gulatenu. We have no excuse to be in America, Canada, Germany, wherever it is, the UK. We all need to call up Nefesh B'Nefesh, take our flights, get going. Maybe you can say if you're still here to do shlichut that you can work something out for a few years. But we got to get on the train. Mashiach's coming. We have no excuse to be here. And looking at the diaspora in any way other than as you know, something that's on its way out is absolutely a no-go. This view is popularized primarily by thinkers such as Rabbi Yehuda Cook, and it's very much a popular approach in Hardal circles in the land of Israel. This is an approach, by the way, that Rabbi Hartstark in his piece did not like very much. He admitted that from the get-go. But it is very much a way that people look at diaspora-Israel relations. I'm sure we can all think of people who hold that view in our lives. Maybe some of us, in fact, ourselves hold that view. And it's one that is very prevalent nowadays in very prevalent circles in the state of Israel. The second view that Rabbi Hartstark laid out is, in fact, its direct opposite. He calls it a diasporist view, which is, you know, why do we care about a Jewish homeland in the land of Israel at all? Jews went into these other countries. We're doing fine. We're wealthy. We have access to education. We're usually seen as white and therefore privileged in a way. Why do we need to go back? We're happy here. We're healthy here. You know, what's going to happen? And that view is literally the polar opposite to the view before, completely discounting any return to Israel, unless it's for, you know, something like Torah study. So those are the two extreme views. And then he brought out two views that were in the middle. The third view that he brought out, which is a view that he spends no time on in the essay, Avram points out in his response, maybe, you know, two, three lines at most, is what he calls a center-periphery model that he associates with the thinker Achad Ha'am, that Jews are out there in the world, wherever we are, we have our culture. That culture is linked inextricably to the land of Israel and what's going on there. That's where our music is being written. That's where our laws are being written. That's where our culture is based. We get our culture, our nationality from there. Yet wherever we are in the world, we tap into that, but we also live our lives. We do our thing. That's natural. That's meant to be. We are in the periphery. Finally, the last model that Rabbi Hartstark brings up, which he explicitly says is his preferred model, was brought by the American philosopher Simon Rabinowitz, which is what he called a dual centers model, that through the hashkacha of history, we have two capitals of Judaism in the world, one in the land of Israel, one in the diaspora, and I think he specifically relates to the US and Canada. And these have developed independently from each other. They have different personalities, they have different priorities, and even in some ways, different ways of relating to the world and the countries around them. They're completely separate in every meaningful way. And they should both be seen as centers respectively of Judaism, learning from each other, interacting with each other, but nonetheless being independent centers of Judaism in their own ways. And that's what he says explicitly is the preferred model that that he had in there. And though I didn't put it on the search sheet, he ends by saying that this is the model that in his own personal life makes him feel less guilty for not making Aliyah. That is a quote from the article. You can make sure that he actually said that and I'm not just saying this. But those are the models that he lays out as being ways of thinking about it. And we can see a little of what we said in universalism versus particularism here. Some approaches, being the diasporist one and the negation one, are very particularist. We care only about ourselves. Thus, to being universalist within the sense of Judaism. Internally within that, having two unique centers that are parallel, that are equal, and we have differences that we accept. However, an issue pointed out is that this model ignores the fact that one of these centers is in our biblical homeland, and the other one is in, whatever insert word before Medina that you want to use from Yiddish literature here. So that's where Avraham comes in, Rabbi Wein, I should say, in his response. He says that the appropriate response to this is to actually latch on to a variation of the third model that Rabbi Hartzog pointed out, the center-periphery model. Though he doesn't associate with Ahad Ha'am, he associates his view with his own teachers, Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig and Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein, respectively, and traces it back through his essay. This is going to be on the Lehr House, hopefully, in 2 months. I don't want to spoil too much, but please read that article when it's out. You can tell me I sent you there. And he traces them, respectively, back to their own teachers, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. This model is what he calls the state and embassy model, or headquarters and embassy model. Medinat Yisrael, this is the bold point in source number 7 that I have. Medinat Yisrael is the headquarters of the Jewish people, but diaspora communities are the embassies of the state. The diaspora communities are critical institutions connected to and extensions of Medinat Yisrael that make valuable constitutions, but are only embassies, not another state. Or in my language, in the name of this year, they are consulates, while the capital base is in Medinat Yisrael. And this view, according to Rabbi Wein, you guys can all download the original article, read his article when it comes out, and make your own decision. But Rabbi Wein thinks that this is a perfect answer to Rabbi Hartstark's concerns, in that it not only provides for a reason for us to be here, we don't have to pack our bags, call Nefesh B'Nefesh right now, but at the same time gives us a sense of mission connected to a broader Zionist ideology. Understanding that our homeland, our headquarters, is in the land of Israel, represented by the state of Israel, but that we are its representatives here, that we have a job that is given to us as ambassadors in our relationship to Judaism, and through that, not only to other Jews, but to the broader community as a whole. And as I said, he connects this model particularly to his teachers, as well as my own teachers, within YU, and in his case, within Yeshivat Har Etzion. And this model brings in both of those ideas. It's particularism that we care about having a mission, a specific mission that we are representatives of, and yet it allows for life and existence in the diaspora communities that we have called our homes for a clear educational purpose and with a clear end goal in mind. So again, we're left with a little bit of a conflict. We have universalist and particularist approaches that seem to be running parallel through tradition. What do we do with that? So I want to share a thought by one particular rabbi who died in the past generation. I believe he passed away in 2007, Rav Shagar, Shimon Gershon Rosenberg. And I apologize for those who wanted the Hebrew of the source. There is an original Hebrew. It was a little bit hard for me to find. I happen to have the book that it's in, and I can send anyone who wanted a photocopy of it. Getting that on the source sheet was a little bit annoying because I couldn't find it online anywhere, and taking pictures of it would have been several pages. But if anyone wants photocopies of it in a PDF, I'm happy to send that as well. But this is the official English translation that Koren put out from it. And Rav Shagar actually uses Sukkot as the paradigmatic example of this approach. Says Rav Shagar, it is precisely the diasporic nature of Sukkah. This is the bolded part of source number 8 on the source sheet. The very Sukkah in which God commanded us to dwell when we emerged from Egypt, when we brought it out of Egypt, where one surrenders one's power, puts their trust in God, and can facilitate an all-encompassing divine influx. That includes the offering of the 70 bullocks, that's the Shivim Parim that we saw above, for the welfare of the world's nations. The Sukkah represents our emuna, our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, no matter what conditions we are in. We leave the comforts of our home to dwell in a Sukkah, to essentially eat there, sleep there, have private conversations there, even according to people, but really live in that Sukkah. No matter what the weather is outside, we give up our comforts in the home for it, showing our emuna in Hashem. Likewise, we are also leaving the comfort of our private dwelling within wherever we live, and are being more visible representatives of Judaism in the world, of what Hashem wants in the broader world. Maybe not necessarily in Israel, where every street is only sukkahs, but certainly in the US and Canada, where we have non-Jewish neighbors, eating in the sukkahs makes us even more visible than we were before. Rav Shagar goes on to write that not only are what he calls nationalism, which is what I've been using as particularism, but also universalism, are both important. The particularism gives us a sense of rootedness. It gives us a connection to an objective truth with a capital T that we know we are to represent in the world. And yet, universalism allows us to understand that there are people who are different than us, who have different opinions than us, who nonetheless we can interact with as, again, ambassadors of a broader mission. That we are able to humanize them, but we are still able to have our traditional rootedness, our sense of connection to Hashem, and our emuna guiding us, powering our identities in every interaction that we have with every person that we interact with. This isn't bolded, but it's the very last paragraph of the source. Jews oscillate between universalism and nationalism, between humanity and covenants. It's a fertile opposition where the loss of one pole immediately damages the other. The Festival of Sukkot represents the Jewish dichotomy between diaspora and homeland. The State of Israel's Harvest Festival, with the sense of stability it includes, is celebrated in the Sukkah along with the exile. Both of these aspects are celebrated in Sukkot. We have the comfort, the stability, the knowledge that Hashem is with us, and yet we are not in our homes where we have air conditioning, where we have a strong ceiling over our head, where we don't have to worry about bugs and apparently bees in Toronto. There are a lot more bees here than there were in America coming in and bothering us. We go into something that is specifically less comfortable, specifically less stable, knowing that Hashem is still with us, knowing that our relationship with Hashem will remain strong no matter what the reality is. Everything that we do within the Sukkah is meant to represent that. Doing our entire lives in that Sukkah and ultimately hoping to form a reconciliation between us and the nations that surround us, leading to a world in which we can all serve the greater ethical monotheist mission of Hashem in the world, bringing everyone together in that sense, unifying us in that shared mission and in that shared love of not only living ideal ethical lives, but also of Torah and mitzvos. I just want to share, I want to end with one little sicha from Rav Menachem Fruman that I found in his book, Chasidim Sofachim Mizeh. It's a wonderful little pamphlet, not so easily available in America. And this story that takes place on Sukkot, I think, is important for this point. It's a very funny, I'll say writing style, but I'll just share it in English. This was a translation done by two rabbis last year. The Rav Fruman would walk into a sukkah, and he would take off his kippah. He would say, as his son, who's also a rabbi, has said, that the kippah could create a barrier between you and the sukkah, a barrier between you and Hashem's Anani HaKavod, his clouds of glory that the sukkah is supposed to represent. And even a small sukkah, a small kippah, something that you wouldn't even think about, might be that. And then you put it back on. And on that same point, he would have his kids do a little swearing-in ceremony when they were young, that just as Joshua would swear that even if the entire world were to become Ovdei Avodah Zarah, Anochi Ubeisi Na'avod as Hashem, me and my household are going to still serve Hashem. So too, Gamim Kol Olam Yu Datiim, even if the entire world was to become religious, Anochi Ubeisi Na'avod as Hashem, me and my household will still serve Hashem. And this actually, to me, represents the core of this message. That no matter how universalist the particular mission becomes, if it is only something that is done by rote, we still must remind ourselves our own particular reason for doing it. Our emuna in Hashem is something personal. It's something particular to us. And my emuna is not necessarily the same as Idan's emuna, which is not necessarily the same as everyone else's. We all have our connection that brings us power to do what we are meant to do in the world. And we also have a mission to that world, that we exist within a world that is not only Jews, but is multiple religions. And we have a mission to be an Or LaGoyim, a light onto those nations, so that one day we can all come and celebrate Sukkot together, sacrificing together for the greater good that is represented by HaKadosh Baruch Hu in not only our lives, but in fact in the life of the world itself. So we understand that these two streams, universalism and particularism, universalism and nationalism in Rav Shagar's language, actually interact with each other. For you cannot have one without the other. If you're entirely universalist, why would you be Jewish? And yet if you're entirely particularist, the entire world is going to burn around us with no one to put out the flames. We need to have that compassion for the world around us, that ability to bring people closer to maybe Torah mitzvos in the case of Jews, but to living a bigger, better, more peaceful world for non-Jews, while also understanding that our mission, our unique mission, is ours, and we have a responsibility to it. And so as we get ready for the Yom Nuraim, as we get ready for Sukkot and putting up our sukkahs, my bracha is that each and every one of us should do introspection and understand what our unique purpose is in the universalist world that we find ourselves living in. On that note, I have about 3 minutes left, so if anyone has any questions, I'm happy to take them, but I'll stop the recording here.